He was glad he hadn't showed up looking like an overprepared kid. But Fiona eagerly joined the chanting. And once Yale did too, he found that the rhythm of his feet on the pavement matched the rhythm of what he was shouting, and soon his heart fell into sync, as it used to when he'd go out dancing. "People with AIDS," a woman with a megaphone would yell. "Under attack! What do we do?" And together they yelled, "Act up! Fight back!" Yale watched for people he knew, but he'd have to be patient. There were thousands of protesters, and in fact it was nice that these faces didn't all have the look of someone he'd seen around Boys Town for years, but just couldn't place. It was good to be part of a horde, a wave of humans. A chant would die out and then stop, as if it had been cut off by an invisible conductor, and then a new one would travel toward them up the street, fuzzy at first, and then he'd hear it clearly once through before joining in. As they passed the Tribune Tower, with dazed tourists looking on, "Health care is a right! Health care is a right!" Outside the Blue Cross building, right on the Magnificent Mile, "We're here! We're queer! We're not going shopping!" Walking down state, the crowd tighter now, louder. "Hey, hey, AMA! How many people died today?" Three laughing teenagers ran right near Yale and Fiona for a while, doing a limp-wristed mocking dance that no one paid attention to. Someone threw an empty cigarette packet out a car window, and it bounced off Fiona's shoulder. Yale spotted Raphael from out loud, walking with a cane, but he was too far away to talk to. There were police all around, blowing whistles, shouting things Yale couldn't understand, but no one seemed to be under arrest yet. No one was getting headlocked. But before they reached the AMA, Yale felt his stomach liquefy. He told Fiona he needed a bathroom. Then she told him he looked pale. They ducked into a hotel, where thankfully no one stopped them, and Yale made it to a fancy single-occupancy restroom down a hall behind the concierge desk, Fiona standing guard outside the door. He called to her that she could leave, and she told him that was silly. She ran out to find a Walgreens and came back with Imodium and Gatorade, although he was feeling better even before she returned. He took his time, sat there 15 minutes, 20 minutes, worried there would be a crowd of bemused spectators when he emerged. He came out to see just Fiona sitting cross-legged against the wall, and he shut the door quickly behind them. "This'll be my defense if they arrest me," he said. "I can just shit my pants. I'll be like a skunk. Or an octopus." Fiona said, "Remember Nico's comic about Hot Todd getting the runs on a date?" Yale did. The strip ended with Todd rushing home, the dream date alone on the sidewalk, left wondering what he'd done wrong. Fiona sat with him on a couch in the lobby. He wanted to rejoin the protest, but not yet. He could use a few minutes to make sure. Fiona smiled like she was about to present him with a gift. She said, "You know he likes you too." He said, "Who?" Even though he knew, or hoped he knew. He felt cold and drained, but now all his blood and breath rushed back into him. "He told Nico, and Nico told me." "Oh, so it was ages ago." "Sure, but people don't let go of that stuff. And I talked to him after you broke up with Charlie. I said he should go for it." She kept talking too loud. She wasn't following his cues to whisper. Although the lobby was mostly empty, and the family at the desk seemed preoccupied. And he didn't go for it. "The thing is, he's not into monogamy, and he knew that was what you'd want." "Jesus. I mean, I don't believe in it anymore. It's the entire reason I'm sick." Fiona tilted her head. "That's kind of the opposite of what happened." "Not really." He was angry and excited and confused, none of which helped his stomach. He wanted more than ever to head back out there, and he knew less than ever how he would hold it together. When he was finally ready, when they slowly stood, he was overwhelmed with what he thought at first was déjà vu. But no, it was a real memory. Leaving the bathroom at Richard's. Walking downstairs to find no one there. What if it happened again? What if they walked back out to a normal day in a normal city, the protesters having marched into the void? Fiona said, "Let's go straight to the county building and wait for everyone by the Snoopy." "By the what?" "The Snoopy in a blender. That statue." It took him a second. "Oh my God, Fiona, that's a Jean Dubuffet. Abstract and white, with black lines. A sculpture that invited climbing." "I am not the only one who calls it that. And we can't all be art experts." He liked the idea of crawling inside it, watching the protests, watching Asher from inside a sculptural shell. They did beat everyone there, aside from some organizers milling around with clipboards, megaphones by their sides. They learned from one that there had been arrests at the AMA, some guys who'd blocked the building's entrance. "They've got Mounties out now," he said. They sat down, leaned against the Dubuffet. Gail said, "It's called Monument Withstanding Beast, just for future reference."
"Nope, no way. Never. Hey, you'll be my date to Nora's opening, right?"
"Maybe you'll bring your sociology professor."
"Ew, my parents will be there."
"Good point," he said. "Definitely better to show up with a diseased gay man. I know that's your dad's favorite." In February, nearly 10 months away, Nora's collection was finally going up at the Brig. After infinite delays, endless nonsense, Bill had messed things up badly, promising the Fujitas on loan to the Ohara Museum in Japan before the Brig even had a chance to display them itself. Miel was still on the mailing list for the gallery, and he'd been alarmed to notice that in the write-up of the show, every artist but Ranko Novak had been listed. Even Sergei Mukenkin was there. He'd called the gallery and pretended to be from Out Loud. Why not? And asked the woman who answered if there was an artist named Novak whose work would be featured.
"I don't see that," she'd said.
And Yale had leaned his head all the way back, left his chin and Adam's apple pointed at the ceiling until his neck ached. At least Nora had died believing she'd given Ranko his show. But whatever part of Yale believed in an afterlife, he was trying to believe, at least lately, felt he'd let her down enormously. She trusted him, had left Ranko's legacy in his hands alone, and he'd failed. And it had been her own work, too, even if she hadn't seen it that way. Yale had wanted, more than anything, to see Nora's portrait of Ranko on the gallery wall, next to Ranko's portrait of her. A secret triumph only a couple of people would ever understand. And now it was all relegated to some storage closet. When he thought about it, his throat constricted. He hadn't told Fiona the news yet. Telling her would feel like telling Nora. Yale and Fiona sat by the Dubuffet another half hour, but then they could hear everyone coming down Clark. And then they were there with their wind-battered signs, sweaty and hoarse. "George Bush, you can't hide. We charge you with genocide." There were news crews now, running backward in front of the mass. He spotted Asher right near the front, and Teddy too. Teddy was doing a postdoc at UC Davis, but he was back for this, and he caught up with Yale at the vigil. He was tan and happy, and he'd gained a few pounds, in a good way. Yale and Fiona joined the chant. "Health care is a right! Health care is a right!" Whatever momentum he'd lost from their detour to the hotel, he easily picked back up again. When was the last time he'd yelled? He'd yelled at Cubs games. He'd yelled at Charlie when they were breaking up. But he hadn't yelled about AIDS. He hadn't yelled at the government. He hadn't yelled at the forces that had denied Katsu Tatami health insurance, At the county hospital system that had made Katsu wait 2 weeks for a bed when he couldn't breathe, and then let him die on a ward that smelled like piss. He hadn't yelled yet at this new mayor and his lip service. He hadn't yelled at the universe. Fiona took his hand and led him into the fray, and they wove their way toward Asher. Asher was busy yelling into his megaphone, but he winked at them, and when he lowered it, he said, "You okay?" Yell said, "You know what this feels like? It's like coming out all over again. I'm in the middle of downtown, shouting about being gay. I'm shouting about AIDS, and it's amazing. Stay with me, okay? You want these?" Asher reached into his pocket, pulled out a roll of silence equals death stickers, put them everywhere, and my friend stuck one right on a horse. Teddy bound it up, told them that back at the corner, Yo couldn't see that far, but he heard the roar from that direction, the whistles and shouting. Women had thrown 15 mattresses into the street to represent the beds that lay vacant from understaffing. They were lying on them, making an impromptu women's ward. But then Fiona pointed up, and then everyone started pointing up. 5 guys were climbing out a window and onto a ledge of the county building. They quickly affixed their banner below the state flag. "We demand equal health care now." Asher started jumping up and down, shouting their names. He said to Yale, "They were in straight drag. They had on button-downs." Now they wore ACT-UP shirts. It must have been a full minute before the police appeared behind the men and dragged 2 of them away. The 3 that remained pumped their fists to the chanting. "The whole world is watching! The whole world is watching!" And although Yale couldn't imagine it was true, would this really earn more than a 30-second spot on the news? It felt good to shout it. When the cops came back, those last 3 clung to the very edge, the flagpole, the banner itself. They looked ready to scale the entire building like Spider-Man. Fiona buried her face in Yale's shirt. Yale wanted to look away, too, but he made himself watch as the police dragged them in by the legs. They got the last one in a twisted headlock. Down here the Mounties paced, pushing everyone back. It was time, apparently, to sit down in the street. Asher said, "You can get out of here. You want to go?" But he didn't. Fiona didn't want to either. Asher said, "You've got a support person?" Yale nodded. Didn't mention that Gloria was home in her apartment, not out here, ready to follow him to jail. "They say get back," the crowd was shouting. "We say fight back." He only hoped his stomach would hold out. He took the Imodium out of his backpack and swigged. Way too much, but he could deal with the consequences later. They sat, part of a Red Rover line of 20 stretching across the street. Asher on one side of Yale, Fiona on the other, and Teddy on the other side of her. Behind them, people stood and chanted and filmed and shouted at the cops. The horses were way too close, and it was hard to tell what was going on, hard to see and hard to hear. A rumor spread down the line that someone had already been kicked in the head by a horse, that one of those sirens a minute ago had been an ambulance. The cops were constantly turning the horses backward, so their hind legs were a foot away from people's faces. They were close enough to smell. When their hooves hit the pavement, Yale felt it shake. An organizer ran down the row. "If they arrest you, go like this," he called, crossing his wrists. Yale asked why, but no one answered. "Don't go limp," the guy said. "They'll drop you on your head." "Are you afraid?" Yale shouted in Fiona's ear. She shook her head, her curls in her face. "I'm too angry to be afraid. I'm too fucking angry. Are you?" "Yes, but I was dying anyway." Someone kept shouting, "No violence." But it was just one voice, not a chant. The cops swarmed closer. They picked a woman off the end of the line and carried her, screaming, to a police truck. They came back for the man next to her, and the man next to him. They wore blue plastic gloves. One wore a paper face mask. There were cameras still, but the news crews had all moved to the side. The people dashing through the front lines with camcorders were protesters recording this for posterity. One stopped in front of Teddy. "Say something," he called, and Teddy shouted, "Their gloves don't match their shoes!" The crowd took it up, an old favorite. "Your gloves don't match your shoes! You'll see it on the news!" The camera moved down to Yale. "Say something," the guy said. "What are you feeling?" It was perhaps the least like Yale Tishman he'd ever felt. If he'd had the rest of his life ahead of him, he might have considered it the first moment of something new. The moment when he finally learned who he was supposed to become. But because he didn't have that, he recognized it for what it was. A spike of bravery and adrenaline that might never be equaled in his remaining time on Earth. He unlinked his arm from Fiona's, and he turned toward Asher, and he grabbed the back of Asher's head and kissed him. Whether Asher was just showing off for the camera, Yale didn't care. But Asher fully returned the kiss, his fingers in Yale's hair, his tongue on Yale's. Yale could taste the salt on his lips, felt Asher's thick stubble against his own smoother chin, even as the entire city fell away around them. When they finally pulled apart, he became aware of Fiona shrieking in delight, of Teddy whooping and applauding. Asher grinned at him, held his gaze, but then the cry went down the line to lie down. Yale flipped his backpack to the front and linked arms again, and lowered his back and head onto the cool asphalt. He closed his eyes and braced himself. He didn't want to get up and walk to the paddy wagon. He wanted to lie still, a passive corpse to be transported, the way people farther down the line had done. Light as a feather, stiff as a board. The shouting got closer, and the whistles got closer, and the screams got closer. He heard Fiona scream when Teddy was taken away, and then a minute later he felt her arm torn away from his. He reached for her, and she was gone. He kept his eyes shut. When they picked him up, it was by his clothes, by his shirt collar, by the backpack, by the waist of his khakis, by the shoes. He tried not to be limp, but he was. He looked at the darkness behind his own eyelids. He thought about how next weekend he was supposed to help Teresa clear out the old apartment. He was supposed to take whatever he wanted of Charlie's and anything of his own that had languished there for 4 years. This weekend he'd do this. Next weekend he'd do that. This was probably easier. It was like being a child and falling asleep on the couch, flopping when your mother carried you to bed. But he landed on the ground, hard, his wind gone, and they flipped him over, his ribcage on the backpack, his cheek against the asphalt, a knee in his back. There were so many voices around him shouting. They yanked his arms behind him and they tightened something around his wrists, and he couldn't move at all, couldn't breathe well, but still they knelt on him. He heard Asher's voice, but he couldn't tell how far away it was. "Why are you doing that to him? Sir? Sir! Why are you doing that?" He resisted. He didn't resist! Sir, he did not resist! He opened his eyes to a horse hoof and the brown fur above it, close enough that he might have stuck out his tongue and licked it. He closed his eyes again. He felt a shoe on his head, holding him to the street. He felt the Imodium bottle in the backpack, ramming into his left lower ribs way too hard. He felt something snap there. A searing, liquid pain. "Sir, this is unnecessary! Sir, he did not resist!" He wanted them to hurry up. He wanted to be in the wagon with Fiona already. He wanted to be home with an ice pack already. He wanted to know his bowels would hold out. He wanted Asher to keep shouting, wanted to keep hearing his voice. He went back to the kiss in his mind. He could live there a long time. It was warm there, and good. 2015. From the bedroom, Fiona Skyped her therapist. Elena's image kept freezing, but the sound would continue, so it seemed as if entire sentences came from her closed lips, or serious questions came from a mouth open in laughter. Elena said,
"Waiting for anything is hard, and this is a lot of stressors."
It was 3 days since she'd knocked on Claire's door, and she'd heard nothing.
"I feel so foolish sitting here," she said,
"and for making Cecily come, when maybe we never even get to meet our granddaughter."
"Has Cecily seen Kurt again?"
Elena was frozen now with her head down, her black curls filling the screen.
"I don't think so. I'm not prying. She took a day trip with her friend, the one she's staying with. And you're connecting with old friends, too. I'm underfoot. And I'm just supposed to hang out 6 more days now till Richard's opening?"
Julian would be back then, at least. He'd had to fly to London, but would return on Monday just in time.
"If Claire hasn't called by then, I'm leaving right afterward."
"Just like that?"
"Well, I could slip a letter under her door first. That wouldn't be such a violation, would it?"
"I think that's a solid plan.
I ruined things by going over there. How was that even fair? I fucked up all along by not being there enough for her, and now I fucked up by smothering her."
Elena took a deep breath. Fiona could hear it rather than see it, as Elena was now stuck with her lips pursed, and said,
"Here's something I've been thinking. We've talked so much about how there are things you can blame yourself for, but how Claire has to share the blame. I know that's been hard for you, to blame Claire. But I wonder if it isn't time to let go of the whole idea of blame."
The sentence crashed Fiona back into 100 conversations she'd had years ago. Asher Glass ranting about blame and shame, the twin scourges that scampered after the virus. Fiona said,
"I've been down that road. The thing is, if you stop blaming people and everything's still crap, the only thing left is to blame the world. And when you blame the whole world, when it seems like the planet doesn't want you, and if there's a God, he hates you, that's worse than hating yourself. It is."
She expected Elena to tell her that she was wrong, that self-hatred was the worst kind. But Elena's pregnant silence stretched too long to be good. Fiona said,
"Hello?"
Elena's hand was frozen near her cheek. She was gone. It was still dark on Wednesday morning when Fiona's phone rang. Then she thought at first it must be someone calling from the States. It was Claire. She said,
"So I want to let you know I'm safe. There's stuff going on like 5 blocks away. I don't know. But we're fine."
"What's happening?" Fiona was on her feet.
"It's a police thing, not another attack. But there's some gunfire."
"Oh, wait, are you...
Thank you for calling, sweetie. Thank you. You're inside?"
"Yeah, this officer came around. We're basically on lockdown." Claire sounded preternaturally calm. Fiona almost would have believed her steady voice if she hadn't known that Nicolette must have been sleeping there beside her. And what mother could possibly be calm in a moment like that? She wanted to fly across the city.
"You're not near a window, are you?"
"Well, it's a small place.
Can you move a shelf in front of the window?"
Claire was quiet, and Fiona worried she'd offended her.
"Yeah, maybe."
"Are the doors locked?"
"Of course."
"And you have enough food? Are you on Twitter? Richard's boyfriend was getting his news from Twitter." Because she wasn't yet awake enough to stop herself, she said,
"This is a sign, Claire, that you should come back to Chicago."
And she was sure then that this had done it, that Claire would hang up. Claire laughed.
"Everyone here is terrified of Chicago. They can't believe I made it out alive. Or we'll get you a safer place in Paris, in a better neighborhood. Your father and I could chip in."
She was literally trying to buy her daughter's affection. Well, her safety first, and then her affection. At 5 in the morning, with a shootout in the background. "Mom," Claire said, "just go back to sleep, okay? Will you call again later?" "Sure. Just don't panic if you don't hear from me, okay?" "I will panic, sweetie. But you could email your dad again if you don't want to call, and he could pass the message on. He appreciated hearing from you." Fiona turned on the TV in the living room, on mute, because she couldn't understand the rapid-fire French anyway, and she logged onto Richard's computer to find CNN. By noon, she hadn't heard from Claire, but she'd heard from the news that they'd caught and killed the last suspect. No reports of any civilian deaths 5 blocks away. It occurred to her to check if her phone had saved Claire's number when she called. "Blocked caller," it said. She ate lunch, and then she called Jake and asked if she could see him again. He, too, was staying here at least until Richard's opening. His story wouldn't be complete otherwise, and his friend was, against what Fiona assumed must have been this woman's better judgment, continuing to let him crash. He asked Fiona if she wanted to go for a walk, and she said no. She'd very much like to fuck him again if he could figure out where that might happen. He called her back with an address, a place that turned out to be a small office building in Saint-Germain, and he led her up to a small, empty office with a window, a desk, a chair, some architectural prints on the walls. "I'm sorry," he said. "I thought there might be a couch at least." It belonged to his friend's roommate's boyfriend, a guy who'd apparently understood instantly and handed over the key. Maybe everyone in France understood things like that. "This is perfect," she said. She sat him in the chair and unbuttoned his shirt, straddled his lap. It was, fortunately, an armless chair. They got it cornered between the desk and the wall so it wouldn't roll around. She lifted her dress, slid her panties to the side, lowered herself onto him. He groaned and tugged her bra down, and very soon, alarmingly soon, they were both done. The whole thing had been a shudder, a sneeze, some quick and involuntary trick of the body. He wrapped the used condom in a sheet of printer paper. "Don't throw it in the trash here," she said. "Walk it down to the street." She was lying on the floor, stretching out her back. Jake put the paper wad on the chair and lay next to her. He said, "Are you okay?" "I just have strange ways of dealing with nerves." "Hey," he said. He ran a finger down her chin, her neck. "Why do you think we met each other?"
"Because you were drunk on the airplane?"
"I mean, cosmically. People don't come into each other's lives like this for no reason. Why'd the universe throw us together?"
"Did you say cosmically?"
"Don't pretend you don't believe in it. Nothing's random. It can't be. The people we meet, the people we're smashed together with, right?"
"I'm not, like, ending up with you. This is not destiny."
"I didn't mean that. I'm being philosophical. Don't you ever think about that stuff? Like, where we go when we die?"
"Christ, Jake, it's 2 in the afternoon.
"I think it's like sleeping," he said. "But you get to help dream up the world. So whatever happens here on Earth, all the weird stuff that just happens, a volcano erupting or whatever, that's the collective dreams of everyone who's ever lived.
So these attacks, a lot of dead people dreamed them."
"Right."
"Huh."
She started laughing.
"Yeah, no. That's very wrong."
"I don't actually believe it, but it's nice to think. And it's just that the world is so weird sometimes, it's the only thing that makes sense."
"You think the dead control us?"
"Sure."
"I'm gonna tell you a secret," she said, and he rolled onto his side.
She had fresh gauze on her hand, and she picked at the edge.
"We're in charge of them. I mean, my friend Julian,
When I thought he was dead, all the things we'd ever said to each other, all my memories of him, they were mine. One of the weirdest things about seeing him again was that something left me. Some kind of energy. Like the air whooshing out of a balloon. Jake said, "Is it a relief, or are you sad?" "Not sad. That would be ridiculous."
"You lost a loss. That's still a loss."
Fiona sat up. "Thanks, Dr. Seuss."
"What? Did I hit a nerve?
Hey, come back!" Out on the street, when she turned her phone on, a message from Claire. Everything was fine. And maybe tomorrow, did Fiona and Cecily, together, want to meet Nicolette and watch her for an hour while Claire was at work, then before Kurt could get across the city to pick her up? Her babysitting had fallen through. 1990. The broken rib prevented Yale from doing more in the apartment than he'd have liked. Teresa insisted he sit on the couch while she paraded box after box of stuff in front of him. Charlie's clothes, which he didn't want. Charlie's books, which he didn't want either. The kitchen things that had once been his, but which he'd long since replaced. Nico's stripy orange scarf. Yale couldn't believe it. He ran his fingers through the fringe. He rolled it carefully into a fat cylinder. He'd give it back to Fiona, finally. Here was his own Michigan sweatshirt, smelling like a crypt. He wondered if Charlie had kept it on purpose, or if it had just stayed buried somewhere, unnoticed. Here was the map of Chicago that Nico had drawn on top of, illustrating the places they'd all been together. A tiny Richard with his camera on the Belmont Rocks. A tiny Julian holding a tray of food by the sandwich shop where he used to work. Yale wearing a beret at the Art Institute. This he would keep. When he reached for it, Teresa said, "Don't keep moving all over. If you don't take full breaths, you'll wind up with pneumonia." It felt good to be mothered. And with Charlie gone, he didn't feel guilty taking up what little mothering energy Teresa had left. So he stayed on the couch that still, after all these years, softened itself naturally to the shape of his body, and let her bring him tea with honey. And he let her fill two big boxes with things he knew he might never unpack. The apartment was bizarrely the same. Charlie hadn't redecorated even a little, hadn't added anything to the walls. The same refrigerator magnets, same sad plant on the windowsill. Yale was glad. It would have felt bad, in some inexplicable, unjustifiable way, to see physical evidence of the ways Charlie's world had moved on. Or maybe it was just that he wanted to believe in a world where this apartment still existed, where it was forever 1985, where the door might open at any moment and there would be Julian with a party invitation, Terrence with beer, Nico with a new comic for Charlie. Teresa said,
"You're not going back to work, are you? Don't even pop in. You know how people are. You check in, and the next thing they'll hand you a mountain of papers. Tell me you'll lounge at home and do nothing else."
He assured her he'd take as much time as he needed. One of the great things about DePaul was how little emotional investment he had in his work. They were currently raising funds for a new parking garage. Yale wouldn't be able to carry these boxes home, even in a cab, so he promised he'd return next week when Teresa was here again from California. She'd been back and forth since Charlie died in December, though Yale wished she'd just go sun herself in the Caribbean for a month and sleep. "The fact that this plant is alive," he said, "means you've been doing too much." He called Asher, who'd volunteered to pick him up. It would be the first time he'd seen him since the protest, since the kiss. Yale had been the last into that particular paddy wagon. So although Asher had been arrested a minute later, he never saw him. In part because, thanks to Fiona's persistent screaming about lawyers, Yale was sent to the hospital rather than put in the holding cell. Asher could be there in 5 minutes. Yao leaned his head back on the sofa, smelled the fabric. Teresa was going around with the dustbuster. He said, I have a story about the map, the one Nico had drawn on. She stopped cleaning, sat on the floor in front of the couch, her knees tucked under her chin. Okay, this little car he drew, way over here? Yao pointed. We were in our friend Terrence's car, and we were supposed to head south on the expressway, but we ended up shooting off west on the Eisenhower instead. Terrence had no sense of direction, which is odd for a math teacher, right? So we got off the highway and got totally turned around, and it's this terrible neighborhood. Yale remembered all of them slinking low in their seats, as if that would keep them safe. But we went in a big circle, and eventually we found all these streets named after presidents, which we thought was good, because they go in order, and they stretch all the way back downtown to the lake. But Charlie was always complaining he couldn't find his way around downtown because he couldn't remember the presidents. If they were named for the British monarchy, he'd be set. So we're going back down to the president streets. You know, Madison, Monroe, Adams, Jackson. And just in that one part of town, before Van Buren, the next thing was this tiny street called Gladys Avenue. And Charlie goes, there was a President Gladys? He was serious. Terrence never let him forget that. Oh my God. He used to make up facts about the Gladys administration. Teresa let out a small, shallow laugh. I'm not telling it right, he said.
No, I like that. I like it very much. He had such good friends, didn't he? He had a family here.
And there was the low buzzer, a sound from his distant past. Yale kissed Teresa's cheek, and she told him again to walk carefully, to breathe fully. Asher didn't have his car. It's too nice out to drive, he said. Yale promised he was okay walking. It really only hurt when he bent or twisted, and Asher suggested they stroll around and wind up at St. Joe's, where he had a 2 o'clock appointment. I'll get you a cab from there, he said. Yale was too nervous to talk normally. He found himself chattering and then falling silent for long stretches. Asher needed to duck over to Halstead to find an ATM. As he pocketed his cash, he said, You heard about County, right? No, Yale hadn't. Cook County Hospital is now officially, drumroll please, treating female AIDS patients. Seriously? That fast? Like, because of the protest? You didn't think it would work, did you? Listen, Yale, I'm not making it up. This shit works. I want you to stay involved. I'll think about it. I need to tell you something. They turned down Briar again, although there were more efficient routes to St. Joe's. I've put off telling people, and I've particularly put off telling you. But I'm moving to New York. Oh. He felt it as a pain in his rib, even though he hadn't twisted, hadn't bent. They were back in front of the apartment now, in front of the same place he'd gotten his heart broken 4 years ago. So why not break it again in the same spot? His cheeks stung. Not his eyes, but his cheeks. How odd. Asher stopped and faced him. There's stuff I can do nationally with ACT UP from there. Stuff that'll make a bigger impact than what I can do from Chicago. Yeah. Who needs Chicago? Yale. No, sorry. It's good. That's really good. Listen, it's like, I was born to fight. I was born angry. I hated my dad. I hated the world. I pick fights with strangers, right? And I look back and it all makes sense. Because maybe I was born for this. Maybe I'm getting religious or something. But it feels like I'm here for a reason. Yale looked at everything that wasn't Asher. Nodded. You know what Charlie said about you once? He said if we didn't have you, we'd have to invent you. Asher laughed. Well, you have me. You had me. You still have me, just It's okay. They started walking again. He could ask him to stay. He could kiss him again and tell him he'd do anything if he just stayed in Chicago. But it wouldn't work. Asher might kiss him back. But there was no version of the future in which Asher chose love. Temporary, fragile, illness-laden love over the fight. And who was he kidding? It wasn't love. It was attraction. It was a seed that might have grown, given better soil, more sun. In every version of the story, Asher was correct. He shouldn't stay here, just to make Yale happy for a year, 3 years, until they both got too sick to make anyone happy. He should be in New York banging on doors and making news. In a way, Yale had already asked at the protest. He'd already received his answer. Here was the house, the one Yale had picked out for himself 1,000 years ago. The piece of the city he was supposed to own. Yale said, "Stop a second."
"What?"
He faced the house, closed his eyes. Then he put his hand on the rolled-up cuff of Asher's shirt. He wanted to bathe in it for 5 seconds. The future he might be having if it weren't for everything. He'd have broken up with Charlie, sure. And Charlie would be coked up in some downtown condo by now. And Yale would have this house. And he and Asher would be together. He was sure. Asher would be lighting the grill in the backyard. Fiona and Nico and Terrence were on their way over for dinner. Julian was hanging out on the porch with a drink, fresh from rehearsal. Asher said,
"Are you okay?"
Yale opened his eyes and nodded. They walked east to right below Belmont Harbor, and then they walked through the park on the path. They talked about Richard, whose solo show was coming up that summer at a gallery in the Loop. "Whoever thought Richard would get an actual show?" Asher said. "I thought it was all an excuse to meet models." They talked about where in New York Asher would live, Chelsea, and when he was leaving, 2 weeks, and how often he'd get back to Chicago, occasionally, mostly for work. They talked about Yale's rib, about the stupid bottle of Imodium that had broken it, about how he didn't care and he'd do it all again. Yale told him about Bill leaving the most important artist out of Nico's great-aunt's show, the guy she loved her whole life. "It was the whole point," Yale said. "It was the point of everything." Asher told him he shouldn't be the one holding power of attorney for Yale anymore. "You need someone who can be at the hospital right away. If I'm in New York, I can't make decisions for you. You should ask Fiona. I'll draw up the papers." Yale might have protested that it took just as long to drive from Madison as to fly from New York. And he might have said he couldn't bear to do that to her. But Asher was right. And there was no one else left. No one he trusted as much. "She'll be done with college by the time you get sick. You have a lot more time." Yale said, "I used to worry about Reagan pressing the button, you know? And asteroids, all that. And then I had this realization. If you had to choose when, in the timeline of the Earth, you got to live, wouldn't you choose the end? You haven't missed anything, then. You die in 1920, you miss rock and roll. You die in 1600, you miss Mozart. Right? I mean, the horrors pile up, too. But no one wants to die before the end of the story. And I really used to believe we'd be the last generation. Like, if I thought about it, if I worried about death, it was all of us I was thinking about. The whole planet. And now it's like, no, it's just you, Yale. You're the one who's gonna miss out. Not even on the end of the world. Like, let's hope the world goes on another 1 billion years, right? But just the normal stuff." Asher didn't answer, but he took Yale's right hand in his left hand, wound their fingers together. They walked on like that, Yale's heart pinballing around his battered ribcage. If Yale weren't physically incapable of sex right now, if Asher hadn't just been talking about the leg pain and nausea he was still experiencing from his pills, Gail might have held out hope that the afternoon would end in someone's bed. A one-time thing. As it was, the hand-holding was an end in itself. An acknowledgement. A dip into that same parallel universe he'd spied on back at the Briar House. And was friendship that different in the end from love? You took the possibility of sex out of it, and it was all about the moment anyway. Being here, right now, in someone's life. Making room for someone in yours. Get a load of these two! A male voice, close behind. Asher tightened his grip on Yale's hand before Yale could even figure it out. Hey, Louise! Get a load of these two!
Don't turn around, Asher whispered.
Yale thought Asher might want to drop his hand, but of course he didn't. Asher didn't even quicken his pace. A woman's voice, farther back.
Bert, don't be an ass!
I'm not the one into asses. Hey, ladies. Give me your time, will you? I got some questions.
Bert!
Listen, ladies. Hold on. But the voices were farther away now. Perhaps Louise had detained Bert. Distantly,
get a load of those two!
Asher and Yale didn't say anything else the rest of the way to St. Joe's. Yale promised he'd get a cab, but then he didn't. He walked to the L. He wanted to be near other riders, packed tight. He wanted to see the city from above, to pass close enough to people's windows that he could see their kitchen tables, their fights. The world was a terrible, beautiful place, and if he wasn't going to be here much longer, he could do whatever he wanted. And the thing he wanted most in the world, besides to run after Asher, was to fix Nora's show. To give Ranko Novak's awkward paintings and sketches their due, such as it was. He thought about people who could help. There were the Sharps, but after everything they'd done for him, he couldn't ask another favor. He hardly knew anyone at Northwestern anymore. He certainly couldn't drag Cecily back into things. Across from him on the L stood a teenager with a column of silver hoops up her ear. It made Yale think of Gloria. Gloria was at the Trib. Gloria would help. He had no idea how, but she would know how. One stop before his own, a man limped onto the train and looked like he was about to lurch into Yale's lap, but then he opened a canvas bag.
Got socks for sale,
he slurred to Yale and the woman next to him.
Dollar pair, $2 three pair, one size fit your foot.
He pulled out a Ziploc with a pair of clean athletic socks, yellow stripes at the top. They looked improbably thick and comfortable.
You got holes in your sock?
This was to Yale.
These make you feel better. Good socks, you feel all better. $1, all better.
Yale found a dollar and gave it to the man, who grinned, toothless, and presented him with the socks. Yale stood for his stop and squeezed the bag. A gift from the city, it felt like. Something soft to put between himself and the earth. 2015. Fiona and Cecily took a painfully long cab ride up to Montmartre, to the garden square where Claire had told them to wait. Traffic was terrible throughout the city. Everyone was back on the road, but the roads weren't back to normal. Fiona wondered if news trucks were still blocking things up, or if everyone was just driving distracted, skittish. Square Géant Rictus wasn't square-shaped, but an oblong stretch of sidewalk looping through shrubbery, enclosed by fences and low brick walls. The green benches, if it weren't for the bird shit, would have been lovely places to sit with a book on a summer day. It was sunny but cold. And Fiona already worried Nicolette would be too chilly, even as she feared Claire and Nicolette wouldn't show up at all. Cecily checked her watch. She said,
"This should have been the hospital waiting room. The two of us waiting together for the baby to be born. Better late than never."
They walked the loop, past the tiny playground. They stopped at the mural next to it, a shiny wall made to look like a chalkboard, with white writing and scraps of red.
"It must be all I love you," Cecily said.
Te amo in one place, a hand making the sign language word for love in another, most of it incomprehensible to Fiona, Thai and Braille and Greek and what might have been Cherokee. Above it all, a painting of a woman in a blue ball gown, with words in a bubble.
Aimer c'est du désordre, alors aimons.
Fiona felt, as she had on the bridge, that Paris, or its more mischievous ghosts, were directing messages straight at her. But that wasn't it at all. This was simply a city that talked about love, that acknowledged its constant invasions, its messiness. What would happen to Chicago, she wondered, if they covered it with things like this? If they filled up Clark Street Bridge with painted padlocks? Cecily squeezed her arm, turned her to the walkway. A little blonde girl, swinging her legs out of a small stroller. Above her, Claire, smiling uncertainly. Nicolette hopped out and ran straight past them to the playground, her pink coat open, rain boots trying to fall off her feet. Fiona and Claire hugged stiffly, and Claire and Cecily shook hands even more stiffly. In the midst of everything else, it hadn't occurred to Fiona till just now that the two of them didn't know each other. Fiona must have carried Claire on her hip a few of those times she'd gone to visit Roscoe the cat, to catch up with Cecily, but those visits had tapered off quickly. Whatever bond had been forced upon Fiona and Cecily in Yale's hospital room didn't have lasting power. Trauma wasn't always the best glue. Fiona turned to watch Nicolette scramble up the steps and cross the little bridge to the slide. She had it all to herself, and it was sized just right for her. She looked less like Nico than she had in the picture, and more like Fiona herself, really. Claire called to her, and she ran back from the bottom of the slide, buried her face in Claire's legs.
"Can you say hi? Can you say hi to Fiona and Cecily?"
It sounded so odd. But maybe, if everything went well, the two of them could pick out grandmotherly names for themselves. Grandy, Nana, Mimi, Maymare, even. She could deal with Fifi, a name she'd rejected her whole life, but one that might sound right coming from a French grandchild. She wanted to squeeze Nicolette, run her hands down those soft cheeks, but she didn't want to scare her, and she didn't want to scare Claire either. Claire handed them a tote bag with Nicolette's snacks and juice, a change of clothes, a couple of picture books. She told them Kurt would be there in an hour and a half.
"And you could come to the bar in an emergency."
It was only two blocks away.
"She's toilet trained?"
Cecily asked, as if she were suddenly remembering a script from decades ago.
"Of course. She won't need to go. She's a camel."
And she was off, with only a couple more instructions, a quick hug for Nicolette, who stared at her two grandmothers with interest after her mother had left, but didn't seem afraid in the slightest. She must have been used to sitters. Fiona sat on the benches by the playground and unpacked the bag so Nicolette could see the crackers, the sippy cup of juice, the Penelope books. A little mouse playing a color game at school in one, learning about seasons in the other. But Nicolette was content for now to do the slide. Run up to the two women and grin while they clapped. Circle back and do it all again. There was time yet to call her over. See if she'd sit on someone's lap. If she'd speak to them in either English or French. Cecily said,
"She's just so beautiful."
That Fiona should double over crying at that precise moment made a kind of sense, absurd as it was. This was the first time Cecily had shown any real emotion at all. And so Fiona's tear ducts seemed to have taken it as an invitation. She could feel Cecily staring at her with concern. And when she looked up, she saw that Nicolette had stopped her circuit and was standing in front of her, her little eyebrows squinched together.
"Did you fall down?"
she said in English so perfect and clear that Fiona could only cry harder.
She's fine, dear, Cecily said. She's just a little sad about something. What is she sad about?
What a question, she managed to say.
I'm sad at the world.
Nicolette looked around as if there was something wrong with the garden square. She said,
My friend has a globe.
Cecily said,
Don't worry about it, honey. Fiona will be fine.
This was convincing enough for Nicolette, who was off again, making cat noises. Cecily put a hand on Fiona's back. Fiona said,
I sent away his mom.
It was the thing she hadn't let herself blurt out to Julian in Richard's studio the other day, the thing she hadn't let herself think about when she learned that Claire had been through labor without her, the thing that had been buzzing at a low vibration beneath her every thought about Claire since she disappeared, and before that as well, the thing she'd mentioned only once to her shrink, even then changing the story enough, downplaying it enough, that Elena had barely noticed the telling.
I don't understand. Yale's mom. Okay. Yale? You did what? I sent... At the very end. I was there, and you had to be in California. Yes. Fiona, you can't... No, listen. You had to be in California, which wasn't your fault. And I was pregnant with Claire. I know.
You don't know. Okay. So I had power of attorney, and this was when he was... All the lung stuff was going on at the same time.
It was terrible,
Cecily said, more like she was affirming Fiona's memory than reliving it herself.
I remember he could barely get two words out, and the indecipherable handwriting. It bothered me. His handwriting had always been so tidy. And he'd write those notes, and I couldn't...
There were some better days, too. Fiona felt bad interrupting, but she needed to get this out while she had momentum.
At the end, and maybe this was when you were gone, it seemed like the treatments were suddenly working for some of the lung stuff. Then he could talk. He really could.
But then his kidneys went, from all the drugs they were pumping in, and the fluids were building up. I can't even remember, but then it was his heart.
He drowned. I said that to the doctors and they said no, that wasn't quite it, but I know what I saw. He drowned.
Cecily said,
You handled it all so beautifully. I can't imagine what you went through, but it was the right decision, keeping him off the ventilator. It was what he wanted.
Nicolette had quit the slide and was making a careful pile of small, dried leaves. Fiona breathed in as deeply as she could, tried to start again.
I counted as 2 whole years, she said, that he was really sick.
Yale had first gotten pneumonia in the spring of 1990, after that stupid fucking cracked rib at the medical protest. It had cleared up, but not really. He had asthma to begin with, and so the pneumonia weakened him more than it otherwise would have. Another issue followed. And another, until he joked that his body was a nightclub for opportunistic infections, joked that he'd named his last remaining T-cells after the Cubs lineup.
And then at the end, okay,
she put her hands on her knees, arms stiff.
4 days before he died, his mother showed up at the hospital.
Cecily's face went still.
I knew who she was, because she'd been in this Tylenol commercial. And every time it came on, I'd stare at her face and try to figure her out. I guess his father, you remember his father came down a couple times, but he just kind of stood around and it was so awkward.
I don't remember that.
Well, he did, and Yale hadn't thought he was really in contact with the mom. But apparently he was, or he figured out how to reach her, and she showed up. She was wearing this yellow sundress. And she looked so nervous. It was at night. He was asleep. Her expression had been so much like the one Yale made when he was anxious.
a look that had always reminded Fiona of a rabbit. It might have made Fiona love this woman, just as she loved Yale. But in